Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today we're reading from the May 2nd, 2025 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week shows the entrance to Soldiers Field at Harvard University. It's a wrought iron gate with between two huge brick columns with the Harvard seal on it. In the entranceway are a huge pile of school desks and chairs, office chairs, just mounded up, creating a barricade. Behind it are a big crowd of, looks like professors and students raising their voice in protest. In front of the barricade, I believe, is Harvard's president, Alan Garber. He has a resolved look on his face. In his left hand, he's holding the Harvard shield, and in his right hand, he has a sword. The headline is, "To the Barricades. Harvard defies Trump in battle over academic freedom." We picked that up on the controversy of the week. We'll start with the first main story. Millions mourn as Vatican prepares for transition. What happened? Catholics worldwide mourn the death this week of Pope Francis, the first Jesuit to lead the Catholic Church, and a strong voice for the marginalized and the dispossessed. Born Jorge Mario Bergoglio in Buenos Aires, he was also the first non-European pope in over a millennium, and he broke from the conservatism of his predecessors to introduce reforms such as allowing priests to bless same-sex unions, restricting the use of the Latin Mass, and inviting women to attend meetings of bishops. Francis, 88, had long suffered from lung problems, and a bout of double pneumonia had him hospitalized for more than 5 weeks earlier this year. On Easter, the visibly ailing Pope gave a brief audience to Vice President J.D. Vance, a Catholic convert. Vance, a vocal supporter of the mass deportation effort that Francis once called a disgrace, said the discussion centered on persecuted Christians. The Vatican said it focused on migrants, refugees, and prisoners. The Pope managed to give a brief Easter blessing to the crowd at St. Peter's Basilica, but was too weak to deliver the homily, and he died of a stroke the next day. Tens of thousands of mourners lined up outside the basilica to view his simple zinc-lined coffin. But unlike most popes, Francis will not be buried in the Vatican. True to his lifetime devotion to austerity, he lived in a two-room apartment rather than the luxurious Vatican Palace and rode in a Ford Focus instead of a limousine. He requested a modest tomb at Rome's Basilica of Santa Maria Maggiore. Cardinal Kevin Farrell, an Irish-born American citizen, will act as interim head of the church until a papal conclave of cardinals is held to elect the new pope. What the editorial said: an increasingly turbulent world has lost a needed voice for peace and human compassion, said the New York Daily News. The Jesuit who once ministered to Buenos Aires slum dwellers, washing their feet, never let the trappings of the papacy change his worldview. While his condemnations of greed seemed increasingly against the grain as society grew coarser and more ruthlessly individualistic over his 12-year papacy, he was steadfast in his devotion to the poor and the outcast. His many humane gestures are laudable, said the National Review, but a full accounting of his papacy requires clarity and truth. Francis had a bad habit of often needlessly characterizing Orthodox Christian belief as an enemy of charity. And though he would eventually dramatically and abjectly apologize for the church's role in covering up the epidemic of child abuse among priests, He spent years turning a blind eye to the misdeeds of church leaders who were close to him. What the columnist said. Francis, liberalism had limits, said Joseph Shaw in First Things. His statements on divorce and same-sex unions stopped just short of full acceptance. His appointments of women to high positions in the Vatican and elsewhere did not satisfy feminist demand for female priests. And on abortion, his statements of compassion for women did not soften the Catholic Church's staunch opposition to abortion. At times, his gestures at compromise often seemed to open rather than paper over ideological rifts among Catholics. Yet he put his stamp on the future of the church, said Gaya Gupta in the Washington Post. He appointed 108 of the 135 cardinals who are eligible to vote for his successor, and they are the most diverse bunch in history, with a majority coming from outside Europe. Still, these men will not necessarily look for a carbon copy of the late pontiff. Top candidates for the next pope include liberals such as Cardinal Luis Tagle of the Philippines, but also the deeply conservative Hungarian Archbishop Peter Erdo, who has opposed allowing divorced and remarried Catholics to receive communion and equated accepting migrant arrivals with human trafficking. Vatican Secretary of State Pietro Parolin, Francis' top deputy, falls somewhere in between. Papal conclaves routinely defy the prophecies of even the most seasoned Vatican watchers, said Eric Bazel Emil in Politico. Francis himself wasn't on the short list of most observers when he was chosen in 2013. At a time when so much is at stake for the future of a faith beset by scandal, no ideological faction of the church is at ease. The Catholic Church, with its more than 1 billion adherents, now stands at a crossroads of Francis' construction. And the controversy of the week is referenced in our cover drawing. Harvard, fighting Trump's assault on its independence. After one American institution, after another, caved to the irrational demands of a lunatic administration, one of them finally stood up and said no, said Charles P. Pierce, an Esquire. The Trump administration recently sent Harvard University a list of outrageous demands, threatening to cancel nearly $9 billion in government funding unless Harvard agreed to regular federal audits of its hiring, admissions, and disciplinary processes, and of the viewpoint diversity of its professors and student body. Harvard President Alan Garber issued a public hell no, pledging that the university will not surrender its independence or relinquish its constitutional rights. Trump's retaliation was swift, said Erwin Kimerinsky in the San Francisco Standard. In a blatantly illegal move, he canceled nearly $2.2 billion in grants without so much as a court hearing and is now threatening to revoke Harvard's tax-exempt status. But unlike Columbia University and many major law firms that Trump has threatened to punish, the university is refusing to capitulate to his mafia-like extortion and quickly filed a federal lawsuit to halt his funding freeze. That should serve as an example to other institutions to stand up to his authoritarian decrees. Giving in to a bully never works. It's not bullying to tell Harvard to stop discriminating, said the Washington Times in an editorial. Trump is simply demanding that Harvard admit students and hire professors based on merit alone, not on skin color, ethnicity, or gender, and that it enforce its own disciplinary rules against students who engage in anti-Semitic harassment. If Harvard, which has a whopping $53 billion endowment, prefers to remain an activist indoctrination center, it should stop taking taxpayer money. Why should Americans fund a university where less than 2% of professors identify as conservative, said Nicole Russell in USA Today. The 80% who identify as liberal, meanwhile, teach students to hate our country and Western values. Harvard's medical and scientific research benefits all Americans, said Atul Gawande in The New Yorker. More than 90% of its federal funding flows to support life-saving treatment at five affiliated hospitals, such as Boston Children's and the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. It also enables Harvard's Medical School and School of Public Health to conduct groundbreaking research on cancer, heart disease, diabetes, Parkinson's, and dementia. If you or someone you love has suffered from these afflictions, you've benefited from federally funded discoveries in care and treatment. The Trumpists don't care, said Andrew Prokop in Vox. In their nihilistic, anti-elitist worldview, choking off funds for pointy-headed woke scientists and doctors is just another delicious way to own the libs. Conservatives may shed few tears for Harvard's elites, said the Wall Street Journal, but they should oppose this unprecedented attempt by government to micromanage a private university. The Supreme Court has repeatedly ruled that federal funding cannot be used to force recipients to surrender constitutional rights. Harvard's right to hire its own faculty and set its own curriculum is one that conservatives should defend, unless they want to see a President Ocasio-Cortez one day defund conservative colleges or revoke the tax exemption of religious schools. Trump should focus on the many actual responsibilities of the presidency. He has enough balls in the air without also trying to run Harvard. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It's a good week for good manners. After OpenAI CEO Sam Altman said the human habit of saying please and thank you to soulless AI chatbots has an upside, even though it costs tens of millions in electricity and computing power for AI to respond in kind. Given the high stakes of the human-machine relationship in the future, Altman said, the cost of teaching AI to be polite is money well spent, adding ominously, you never know. It's a good week for prehistoric skin care. After University of Michigan researchers concluded that early Homo sapiens may have used a form of sunscreen about 40,000 years ago. Topical applications of the pigment ochre may have helped early cave-dwelling humans survive during an age of increased atmospheric penetration by energetic particles. And it was a good week for faint praise. After President Trump said former President Jimmy Carter died a happy man because he knew he wasn't the worst U.S. president in history. Joe Biden was. But it was a bad week for contraband. After a pair of Belgian 19-year-olds were arrested in Nairobi and charged with attempting to smuggle 5,000 ants out of the country for sale on the black market. It's a bad week for hopping. After an engine fire that forced the emergency landing of a United Airlines flight from Denver was blamed on a wild rabbit that got sucked into the plane's second engine during takeoff and caused it to explode into a fireball. It's a bad week for deja vu. After the postponement of Fry Festival 2, a supposedly better-run luxury music festival than the shambolic 2017 original. Officials of the Mexican island of Isla Mujeres, where FF2 had been scheduled for May, said no concerts had been approved. This is an event that does not exist, said the official. Title of the briefing this week is strongman for hire. El Salvador's leader is offering his giant prison for U.S. deportees and punitive populism as a model. Who is Nayib Bukele? He is the 43-year-old president of El Salvador, who calls himself the world's coolest dictator and a philosopher king. Since his 2019 election, Bukele has consolidated power in the Central American nation and presents himself as a tech-savvy 21st century leader. Highly image-conscious, he is active on social media, often dresses in black, is fond of leather jackets, and sports a sharply sculpted beard. Bukele has successfully made war on the violent gangs who once terrorized the country, but at a price. El Salvador has the highest incarceration rate in the world, with 1 in 13 young men behind bars, some as young as 12. A single anonymous tipster's phone call can land someone in a teeming, overcrowded jail, where unsanitary conditions, torture, and ritual humiliation wait. But because gang violence has subsided, Bukele has an 83% approval rating, and he's offered his hardline policies as a model for the U.S. at last year's Conservative Political Action Conference. How many young people have you lost to the streets of Philadelphia or San Francisco to fentanyl, he asked. Dark forces are already taking over your country. How did he become president? By exploiting widespread disillusionment with El Salvador's corrupt, incompetent leadership. Bukele was born into a large, wealthy Christian Palestinian family. His grandfather arrived in El Salvador in 1921, and his father converted to Islam, became an imam and public relations magnate, and launched the country's first McDonald's. Bukele is not religious, but says he's Christian. After running some small businesses and a political advertising firm, he entered politics and became mayor of San Salvador in 2015. 4 years later, he launched a mostly online campaign for the presidency as an anti-corruption maverick, demanding of establishment opponents that you bastards return what's been stolen. At 37, he became the country's youngest ever leader and immediately installed his brothers, other relatives, and friends in his cabinet. How has he governed? With la mano dura, an iron fist. He's fired judges, used troops to intimidate legislators, and gerrymandered the country's electoral districts to benefit his New Ideas Party, which now has a supermajority. Journalists and activists have found their phones hacked and their messages drowned out by swarms of paid online trolls. At first, Bukele reportedly worked with the country's two main gangs, MS-13 and Barrio 18, to limit violence. But when they killed 87 people one March 2022 weekend, he immediately declared a month-long state of exception, which he has since renewed 33 times. Police with triple-digit daily arrest quotas raided homes and made warrantless arrests. Tens of thousands of gang members were given mass trials and jailed. Human rights groups estimate at least 25,000 of the 100,000 prisoners are not criminals and attribute nearly 300 prison deaths to torture. Former prisoners have reported enduring frequent beatings, sharing one toilet among 150 people, sleeping in excrement, and eating just two meager meals a day. In 2023, Bukele opened the Terrorism Confinement Center, or CECOT, for 40,000 prisoners. The government has vowed the inmates will never leave unless they're in a coffin. Everything in life has a cost, Bukele says, and the cost of being called authoritarian is too small to bother me much. What do Salvadorans think? Independent polls show overwhelming support for Bukele. A decade ago, gang violence had made El Salvador a de facto war zone, with an unrivaled homicide rate of 105 per 100,000 people. By 2023, an independent researcher found it fell to 4.5 per 100,000, just under the U.S. murder rate, Residents who once feared leaving their homes to buy food say they now let their children play in the street. "We're starting to feel security," said Noe Del Cid, who was partially paralyzed by gunfire in 2003. "He took the action that we needed him to take." Who else supports Bukele? In Latin America, political parties in Honduras, Ecuador, and elsewhere cite Bukele's name and promise to follow his tough-on-crime approach. La Mano Dura has fans in the Trump administration, too. In February, Bukele offered to rent out space in CICAT for U.S. migrant deportees. And when the first flights landed in March, his ex-profile was brimming with retweets of praise from Elon Musk, Secretary of State Marco Rubio, and other Trump allies. "Needs to happen and will happen in the U.S., Musk tweeted. Does Bukele have a vulnerability? Yes, El Salvador's economy. Despite a sharp decline in crime, the impoverished country has seen little foreign investment. And Bukele's spending on security, COVID aid, and splashy infrastructure projects helped push the country's public debt to 84% of its GDP. He has promoted government investment in cryptocurrency and now claims he can produce revenue with forced labor at CICAT through a zero-idleness program. The Trump administration is paying El Salvador $6 million to house deported migrants, and Bukele has offered to house additional thousands of American-born prisoners, including citizens convicted of crimes. "You have 350 million people to liberate," Bukele told him. "To liberate 350 million people, you have to imprison some. We are very eager to help." Moving into a few of the best columns. First two come from the U.S. Will SCOTUS precedent stop Trump? What goes around comes around, said law professor Aaron Tang. The major questions doctrine, championed by the Supreme Court's conservative justices to restrain the Biden presidency, could soon come back to haunt President Trump's boldest assertions of authority. The High Court relied on this particularly potent brand of judge-made law to strike down the Biden administration's student loan forgiveness program and to limit its ability to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. The invented doctrine requires the executive branch to cite a clear congressional authorization when making policy of great economic and political significance. Now a blizzard of lawsuits is seizing on that Supreme Court precedent to challenge Trump's boundless claims of presidential power. One lawsuit seeks to halt the Department of Government Efficiency's reckless across-the-board layoffs and cuts, while another takes on the cancellation of billions in funding for public health. In another suit, the conservative New Civil Liberties Alliance argues that Trump wasn't authorized by Congress to implement his sweeping tariffs. If the court's conservative majority is consistent and treats Trump as it did Biden, this dubious doctrine could save our constitutional order. Another Russian puppet. President Trump's nominee for U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia has completely disqualified himself, said Tom Nichols. Acting U.S. Attorney for D.C., Ed Martin, is a conservative podcaster and fierce MAGA loyalist who has called Justice Department prosecutors President Trump's lawyers. Martin is also a Russian state TV darling. It was revealed last week that he appeared on RT America, the Kremlin's English-language propaganda outlet, and its sister outlet, Sputnik, 150 times from 2016 to 2024, spouting conspiracy-laden anti-American rants, parroting Russian talking points about Ukraine and Vladimir Putin's interference in U.S. elections. Sorry, but a U.S. attorney shouldn't be a regular on the state television outlet of a neo-fascist dictatorship. Martin initially failed to tell the Senate about his appalling comments on RT, which offer a significant warning sign about his lack of prudence and his evident political extremism. In Trump's administration, defending Russia while slagging America is hardly unique, but Americans should be wary of any aspiring Justice Department official who gladly contributes to Russian propaganda efforts. This column comes from Uganda. Why we should wean off aid. Humanitarian aid isn't always the game changer international charities claim in their glossy reports, said Michael Gumisiriza. As an aid worker in my native country, Uganda, I've seen this firsthand. Much of the work that aid organizations do is but a well-dressed performance, carefully packaged, transactional, and self-serving. Host governments welcome people fleeing war and famine, not out of pan-African solidarity or hospitality, but as a means to court dollars and soft power. Refugees have learned the script, dutifully thanking aid groups for improving their lives to provide a line in the next funding proposal. Their suffering becomes merely currency. As a refugee elder in one camp put it, the cow that bellows the loudest gets the salt. But this charade breeds dependency and undermines local innovation that could solve problems at the source. What if we stopped aid altogether? Yes, some would suffer, even die. But haven't people been quietly dying anyway in overcrowded camps? With foreign aid drying up, nations hosting refugees will be forced to come up with new strategies, like giving people land to start new lives. And maybe that's necessary. The constant flow of donor aid can hold the needy back, leaving them helpless when projects end. If your humanitarian mission dies when the money dries up, it was never a mission. It was a business. The last word, our feature article. The goodbye line. Two artists asked strangers to call and say goodbye to anyone or anything, said Todd Martins in the Los Angeles Times. Messages of mourning and nostalgia came flooding in. Alexis Wood received a notification on her phone. It was an anonymous call from a payphone. She listened and was momentarily paralyzed, and then she couldn't stop crying. The call wasn't completely unexpected. Days earlier, Wood and her partner, Adam Trunell, had gone prowling for working Los Angeles payphones, placing stickers on them that invited passersby to make a free call to a recorded line to say goodbye. What surprised her was the message. The voice on the other end of the line sounded like a young man who confessed that he thought the toll-free 888 number would allow him to call his mother. Once he realized it wouldn't, he pivoted and followed the recorded prompt to say goodbye, to remember to pay respects, to turn the page, to a loved one or part of yourself. "I'd like to apologize to my family," the voice said. "I hope y'all make it to heaven. I'm sorry I didn't make it." It was short, but powerful, and Wood listened to it again on repeat. "I started to cry," Wood said, sitting with Trunell in a downtown coffee shop. "I didn't realize this was going to have that effect on me, and that this was a very real, authentic moment for someone." Alternately rebellious and nostalgic, the goodbye line is an art project found on payphones throughout the L.A. area. Yes, this payphone works. The stickers read in blocky text against the red and white backdrop. The instructions continue with the line, Someday, these will be gone, like you, me, and everyone else, prior to inviting the reader to leave a message before it's too late. People are calling. Goodbye is such a part of life, said Trinnell, a documentary filmmaker who started the experiment with wood last year. It's all us coming and going, coming and going. We all share that. And it makes it less lonely, less scary. Not that it makes it easier. At a payphone in Hollywood, someone says goodbye to their best friend. At downtown's Pershing Square, two women say goodbye to payphones, lamenting the loss of anonymous calls. Caller reaching out from Altadena's Cheney Trail sings a song, urging people to say goodbye to anyone, anything, because you never know when it's your time. And it's not the same without you, says someone from West Hollywood's Plumber Park in an ode to a lost pal. The anonymous messages are edited and posted on social media for all to hear and share. Those who wish to keep their messages private are instructed to say so on the call. They are snapshots of grief and our desire to connect, but also audio logs of loneliness in Los Angeles. Payphones, or the neighborhoods they're in, rather, have personalities. And while messages have spanned the spectrum from light to heavy, they're almost all rooted in a desire to tap into a broader community. We learn that loss and grief is a process, and mourning isn't something that's purely private, Trinnell says. It's deeply communal. When you see the likes, the comments, and the shares, even if you're not the one leaving the message, you hear yourself in the goodbye. Payphones are rapidly disappearing. Though there were more than 27,000 statewide a decade ago, the California Public Utilities Commission reported that as of March, there are 2,525 active units in California, with 484 in Los Angeles County. In Los Angeles proper, only 149 remain. As the goodbye line is now more than a year old and finding a broader audience, calls have started to stream in from cell phones. Trinnell and Wood encourage its spread, of course, but it's the payphone calls that hold a special place in their hearts. I'm not trying to draw any science around it, but it does seem like people who go to payphones are more in the moment, said Trinnell, noting that cell phone calls tend to be a bit longer and a little more considered. You use a payphone in a different way than you use a cell phone. It's not in your pocket. It's not connected to a camera. You go and do this goodbye in a place that's different from where you do most of your business. You hear a dial tone. That's the sound of waiting. Then you leave a message, as if you just dug a hole in the ground. As long as the stickers have been active, the couple, who have been romantically partnered for about 4 years, have received a few each week from payphones. Every payphone number is saved in the cell phones of Wood and Trinnell with various emojis. One payphone is next to a laundromat, so we have bubbles and soap bar, Wood said. You see it pop up, and you know what messages are going to come through. And those messages are heavier, Trinnell says. He notes that in neighborhoods such as Hollywood, Westlake, and Skid Row, callers tend to get a little deeper into their trauma. In May of last year, a call came in from a payphone to the Hollywood corner of Yucca Avenue and Wilcox Street. It was a goodbye that had not been able to be said. Goodbye, Donnie. You were my love from 2017 to a few years ago, but you died last year, and I didn't know for a long time. It made me very sad. Trinnell, 46, stresses that the goodbye line wasn't rooted in any personal sense of grief or loss. He and Wood, 37, who has a career in tech, have long flirted with collaborative creative projects, some serious, some silly, such as potentially designing tiny hats for snakes. Yet being involved with a project that is so intimately voyeuristic into the lives of strangers, sometimes at their most emotional, can take its toll. A recent call caused serious reflection for Trinnell. It was a goodbye to a mother who died when the caller was a teen. Her passing was unexpected, and the caller noted their last conversation was arguing about middle school grades. "You thought that I might kind of squander my education," the caller said, before revealing that he believes he would have made his mother proud. "I love you, and I miss you, and this has been a long overdue goodbye," the caller said before hanging up. "Maybe it was the suddenness of it," Trinnell said. "You kind of just walk into this and realize how all of this feels. It just sort of happens. The reward is unexpected connections and reminders of your own humanity. I'm worried about my folks dying, but I don't think how it's going to change me. This just feels like a very human project. It takes you out of whatever BS is going on." Not all the calls, of course, are so deep. The Cheney Trail payphone, which has been offline since the Eaton fire in early January, long had a persona of its own, said Wood, one that often was a little more lighthearted. Perhaps expected for a phone on a hiking trail, the calls have tended to lean more toward thoughts of self-actualization than tales of grief, such as a caller saying goodbye to his former, heavier self. "You get surprised sometimes, but Cheney Trail, for instance, is people saying goodbye to my past and hello to my future," Wood says. And then, of course, there are the clearly drunk dials, such as two middle-of-the-night rings from a payphone near Pasadena Police Station. "This girl left two messages," Trinnell says. "You could tell she had been out. She might have had a couple." Downtown artist S.C. Merrow, whose own public art often unexpectedly appears on sidewalks and buildings throughout the city, has championed the goodbye line on her social media channels. "You walk around every day and you don't really think about what's going through people's minds," Merrow said. "This is such a reminder that everyone walking by is going through something and going through things similar to what you're going through." She tends to think of each call as a mini short story. Most art, when you're looking at it, you're looking at the beginning, middle, and end. Trinnell and Wood are still learning what responsibility they had to callers. They both have day jobs, and editing and posting the messages takes work, especially because Trinnell is running them through a vintage oscilloscope that he found on Craigslist for $50. He wants the Instagram post to have a ghostly, nostalgic feel. And some messages will never be posted. One late night, for example, a frightening call came in from a cell phone, one in which someone seemed to be saying goodbye to their own life. "You need to text him," Trinnell recalls thinking at the time. "It sounded like a kid, and it was a super brief message, and you don't know if it's serious or not. This is something that might come up, so what do we do? I texted to check in, but you don't expect the goodbye line to call you back. I just said, 'Did you leave a message?' 'I'm leaving the door open.' He never heard back." Trinnell and Wood say they spend some of their weekends driving around L.A. looking for working payphones to place stickers on. It's harder than one might think. And over the past 13 or so months, they've found only 20 active phones out of the supposed 149 around the city. But they're making more stickers and have even incorporated the project into their vacations, leaving one on a phone in Santa Fe, although they have not received a call from it and don't know if the sticker is still there. Yet after securing well over 100 calls, they know the goodbye line is filling a void. "Initially, I wanted to hear people's voices," Trinnell said, noting that perhaps the project was a reaction to our social media-driven age as much as it was a throwback to, say, communal phone lines of yore. "I wanted a place where we would get to hear people saying things. We just didn't have that. There was no big epic idea. It's filled in around us, and a weird way, it was like forums online, but we can do that with voices." Curiously, the goodbye line has avoided posting calls that involve romantic drama. While there are no rules as to what the two may consider fit for sharing on social media, Trinnell says that messages aimed at exes and former lovers can feel trivial to him. "You realize they're mad at somebody or saying goodbye to someone who's still around," Trinnell said, "and you're kind of like, go repair that relationship." It reveals perhaps an underlying thesis of the goodbye line. Its existence is a reminder of life's impermanence. As much as it encourages us to say goodbye, it's also a nudge to never stop picking up the phone to say hello. The story was originally published in the Los Angeles Times. And we'll pick up two or three of the health and science short pieces today. An Ozempic-style drug in pill form. Patients may soon get the benefits of Ozempic by simply swallowing a pill, the New York Times reports. Eli Lilly said its new GLP-1 pill, orforglipron, appears to lower blood sugar and promote weight loss in diabetics as effectively as popular injectable drugs. In a clinical trial, more than 500 people with type 2 diabetes were given either orforglipron or a placebo for 40 weeks. Those who received the medication saw their blood sugar levels drop by the same amount as in trials of injectables Ozempic and Mounjaro. 65% of those taking the pill saw their blood sugar levels reach the normal range. They also lost up to 16 pounds, about equal to Ozempic's typical weight loss, but slightly less than Mounjaro's. More trials need to be done to assess for adverse effects, and Pfizer halted its own trial of a similar pill after a participant showed signs of liver damage. But if the results demonstrate that a daily pill is just as safe as a weekly shot that requires refrigeration, then access to treatment could be vastly expanded. More than 10% of Americans have diabetes, and about 40% are obese. In the coming decade, 700 million people around the world will have type 2 diabetes, and over a billion will have obesity, said Daniel Skovronsky, Lilly's chief scientific officer. Injections cannot be the solution. New plastic created from plants. Scientists have developed a plant-based material that could offer an environmentally friendly alternative to see-through plastics, reports New Scientist. Biochemist Noriyuki Isobe and his team at the Japan Agency for Marine Earth Science and Technology developed the product, called transparent paperboard, from cellulose, a fibrous compound that makes up the walls of plant cells. Cellulose is already used to make transparent wraps, such as cellophane, but that's too flimsy for most applications. Isobe's team found a way to stiffen the material by treating it with lithium bromide. A cup made of the resulting paperboard can hold just boiled water for over 3 hours with minimal leakage. It is not only shapeable, but also has the potential to serve as a sustainable alternative to conventional plastics, said Isobe. While plastic can take centuries to break down, leaching toxins and clogging our oceans and waterways, transparent paperboard degrades completely within 300 days in the ocean, and even more quickly in shallower water. And it can be made not only from virgin plant cellulose, but from cellulose pulled from recycled materials, including discarded clothing. That means, scientists say, it can play a pivotal role in the sustainable circular economy of the future. Life beyond our solar system? We might not be alone in the cosmos. An international team of astronomers has found the strongest evidence yet that there could be life on a planet far from our solar system. Known as K2-18b, the planet was scrutinized because it's a decent candidate. Just 124 light years away, it orbits its red dwarf star in the so-called Goldilocks zone of habitability. The researchers believe that the planet has liquid water, and they've identified a possible biosignature. The atmosphere appears to show traces of the molecule dimethyl sulfide, which on Earth is exclusively produced by microbes. While K2-18b isn't clearly visible through a telescope, its orbit can be seen from Earth when it crosses the dwarf star. That journey alerts the starlight spectrum, creating a pattern that reveals the planet's atmosphere when viewed from an advanced telescope. The astronomers caution it will take far more research before they can conclusively declare that life must be present. But the lead author of the University of Cambridge tells the Washington Post that this could be potentially one of the biggest landmarks in the history of science. On the Talking Points page, we will start with resistance. AOC and Sanders hit the road. There's a long list of liberal politicians who are mad as hell, said John Hendrickson in The Atlantic. But Vermont Independent Senator Bernie Sanders and Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the Democrat from New York, are two of the few who genuinely aren't going to take it anymore. They've been crisscrossing the country on the Fighting Oligarchy Tour, drawing at least 200,000 people to their rallies. They are visiting blue and red states alike, filling stadiums in Arizona, Idaho, and Montana. The American left's favorite double act is filling the void of opposition left by Democratic leadership. Sanders has been railing against billionaires for decades, but his rhetoric has never been more resonant as the stock market nosedives and Elon Musk, the world's richest man, guts the federal bureaucracy. At 83, Sanders is nearing his career's end, but 35-year-old Ocasio-Cortez is hitting her prime, raising questions about a presidential run in 2028. We need a Democratic Party that fights harder for us, she said to 36,000 people in Los Angeles. She and Sanders are attacking apathy, even if that means targeting timid Democrats. All this might please the rallygoers, but it's not exactly a fresh shtick, said Noah Rothman in National Review. Since January, Democratic voters have sought futile emotive gestures from their representatives, and these two are the first to supply them. Sanders and Ocasio-Cortez play to their Democratic socialist base by blaming every woe on economic inequality. Of course, their magical misery tour is packing arenas, but it only proves the market for retributive paranoia is not yet saturated. Not everyone is feeling the burn, said Perry Bacon Jr. in the Washington Post. This tour's success doesn't mean rank-and-file Democrats are clamoring for the party to become more progressive. What they want are leaders who will not be so hesitant to take on President Trump and Elon Musk. The fear of Trump's retaliation cuts across parties. We are all afraid, Senator Lisa Murkowski, the Republican from Alaska, said last week. Democrats are looking for fighters who will overcome those fears. It will take a mass counter-movement to combat Trump, said David Brooks in the New York Times. AOC and Sanders provide a hint of something larger, but their partisan rallies make this look like a normal contest between Democrats and Republicans. And what's happening isn't normal. I'm not a movement guy and don't naturally march, but Trump is shackling the greatest institutions in American life. We have nothing to lose but our chains. Reigning in Iran, talks instead of bombs. President Trump is well positioned to secure a lasting deal with Iran on its nuclear program, said Ivo Dalder in Politico. Unfortunately, it may be on Iran's terms. Since 2018, when Trump scrapped President Barack Obama's Iran nuclear deal, Tehran has been enriching uranium and now has a stockpile at 60% purity. At this point, it could jump to the 90% purity required for a bomb whenever it chooses, and that has alarmed Israel, which considers a nuclear Iran an existential threat. Israel was reportedly planning to bomb Iran's facilities, but Trump insisted on talks first, bombs second. The carrots and sticks approach has brought Iran to the negotiating table, And U.S. Envoy Steve Witkoff has met twice with Iranian diplomats in the past 2 weeks. But whatever deal emerges is likely to be a near clone of Obama's pact, which Trump derided as the worst deal in history. Critics of the original deal may again be left wanting something more stringent. A tougher agreement is still within reach, said Arash Azizi in The Atlantic. Iran is in a weak, even humiliating position, with Israel having humbled Iranian proxy militias in Gaza, Syria, and Lebanon. Internal discontent over the Ayatollah's political repression and economic mismanagement has swelled, and voices favoring engagement with the U.S. are gaining strength. There's hope Iran could accept real concessions that create a more enduring check on its nuclear ambitions. Don't count on it, said Brett Stevens in the New York Times. Iran has been playing Western diplomats for fools for decades. The heart of the problem isn't the level of nuclear enrichment, but the Iranian regime, with its raging anti-Americanism and anti-Semitism, and its long record of supporting terrorism. Rather than the same old deal, Trump should offer normalization for normalization. The U.S. would lift sanctions and allow unfettered trade to bring prosperity to Iranians if, in exchange, Iran renounced nuclear weapons, terrorism, and repression and became a normal country. To add to the pressure, the U.S. could give Israel the bombers it needs to wipe out Iran's facilities in a case of a no. But outsourcing our military muscle to Israel would be a profound strategic error, said Dan Perry in The Hill. It sends the message that Trump's White House, like Obama's, lacks the will to enforce its own red lines. The Ayatollahs must understand that if they try to stall, their cataclysmic rule will be ended. That message must come from Washington, not Tel Aviv. Tariffs, the quest to bring back manly jobs. President Trump and his advisors have offered many rationales for his tariff obsession, said Emily Stewart in Business Insider. But a key goal is often overlooked: to make work manly again. MAGA World thinks that Trump's levies on cheap imports will drive a renaissance in American manufacturing and bring back a time when men toiled with their hands in factories or mines instead of getting soft and feminized email jobs. The concept of testosterone-boosting jobs drew recent cheers from Fox News host Jesse Waters. When you sit behind a screen all day, it makes you a woman, he said. The prospect of a factory boom excites internet incels who can't find a wife or girlfriend, said Constant Grady in Vox. They believe it will shift the economy back to 1950s-style manly employment while shifting away from work that has enabled women to become independent. If women once again need economic support from men, these lonely dudes think, they will be incentivized to sleep with them, and the world will be restored to its proper order. Trump and the idiotic fanaticist who share his vision overlook an inconvenient reality, said Kevin D. Williamson in the Dispatch. Manufacturing, mining, and other working-class jobs are often dangerous, dull, and physically punishing. The sons and daughters of men who did them were generally quite happy to move into white-collar jobs. People don't want to stand in front of a 2,000-degree blast furnace, Gary Cohn, Trump's first-term chief economic advisor, reportedly told Trump when he rhapsodized over lost industrial jobs. But Trump, who's never been within smelling distance of a blue-collar job, fails to understand that people do those jobs because they do not have a lot of other choices. In the modern economy, people do have other choices, and Trump can't change that. Beneath the culture war posturing lies a real labor market quandary, said Henry Grabar in Slate. Men without college degrees are struggling to find jobs that pay well. But Trump's tariff chaos won't bring back manufacturing work now largely performed by robots and technology. This isn't really about creating jobs, said Rotimi Adeoye in the Washington Post. It's about creating vibes. Trump's tariffs won't revive steel plants, coal mines, and rugged masculinity, or deprive women of office and service jobs. He's just feeding the fantasy that the old America still waits, if you can just hurt the right people to get there. In the shorter notes, last year 11.4% of U.S. children, about 7 million, had been diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, a record high and up from 3% in 1993 and 6.6% in 2000. Between 2012 and 2022, the number of U.S. prescriptions for stimulants to treat ADHD increased by 58%. Border crossings have sunk to their lowest levels since the 1960s. Southwestern migrant encounters plummeted over the last year of the Biden administration from 249,785 in December 2023 to 47,324 in December 2024. Under the Trump administration, they've dropped further to just 7,181 in March. On the poll watch, 67% of U.S. Roman Catholics believe Pope Francis was a very good pope and one of the best. 39% want the next pope to be a reformer like Francis. 34% prefer a traditionalist. And we'll finish out today's show with a quote by science fiction author Arthur C. Clarke, who says, "Two possibilities exist. Either we are alone in the universe, or we are not. Both are equally terrifying." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, give us a call, 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.